Getting serious about Ebola today, Monday, September 15th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A medical team from Boston heads off to Liberia today. I asked the doctor in charge why the international response to Ebola has been so slow.
Unfortunately, Marco, I think it's racism. I think it's easy for the world to ignore.
We'll find out what her organization is doing to step up. Also today, a photographer who documented his Asian American version of the Brady Bunch back in the 70s.
When you kind of photograph your own family, it's very hard. You'll get the hand in the face, you know, just don't do this. And it just makes you want to quit. But I was persistent, and I think I just basically broke them down.
Plus, what it takes to land a robot on a comet at 34,000 miles an hour.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Here's the thing about the battle against ISIS. It isn't just military. Yes, President Obama has vowed to use airstrikes to destroy the militants who brand themselves the Islamic State, and U.S. officials are working overtime to build a coalition of nations to support that effort. But there's also a spiritual front in this war. Moderate Muslims around the globe denouncing ISIS's brutality as completely un-Islamic. That's a message from Muslim leaders in Scotland today. They're reacting to yet another shocking video posted online by ISIS over the weekend, this one showing the execution of David Haynes, an aid worker from Scotland. I asked Maza Khan with the Muslim Council of Scotland what he thinks of ISIS.
This group is a dangerous group, and their brutality proves that they are far from being an Islamic state. They are actually an un-Islamic state. And we condemn unequivocally their actions in murdering individuals. In the case of David Haynes in particular, who was an aid worker there to help people on the ground, sacrificing his time and then end up to be murdered, is absolutely reprehensible.
Leaders there have called on young Muslims not to travel to Iraq and Syria to support or fight with this ISIS group. Do you feel that there is a large wave of young Muslims who want to join, or is it just a small group?
Muslim Council of Scotland don't have any accurate information in terms of how many people have gone across to that region. We have come across at least two cases of individuals from Scotland, one person from Aberdeen who turned up on a video, and another female, Aksa Mahmood, literally a couple of weeks ago, who has also turned up in that region as well.
Can you take us inside the minds of young Muslims, if you could, and what motivates them to go there?
Well, going back the last 18 months or so, there was a genuine humanitarian concern in that region which drove people to travel there. And therefore, people genuinely wanted to go there to help people on the ground. And many, many people did go. And many people came back with aid convoys and so forth. However, there are young people who can be naive, sadly even brainwashed by extremist groups there. We've seen this happening, and so we were discouraging wholeheartedly that people should not travel there, even if it's for humanitarian reasons, if that's their reasons to travel there, that it's far too dangerous for anybody to take that risk.
How much weight or influence do you think the Muslim community has with ISIS? Or does ISIS consider someone like you a moderate and just as heathen as the British and US governments?
I don't even know, ISIS even know that we exist, frankly. You know, we only care for our own communities in Britain, in Scotland. That's who we speak for, and that's our primary concern. We recognize what this group called ISIS represents. It's a dangerous, violent organization. It has nothing to do with Islam. It uses the term Islamic State. Just literally last week, a coalition of Muslim organizations in England actually wrote an open letter to the Prime Minister, David Cameron, requesting that the name Islamic State should not be used for this group, because by using the term Islamic State, you're actually legitimizing this group as being Islamic. They are not Islamic. They're far from Islam. They are rejected by not just the consensus of Muslims in the UK, but the consensus of Muslims across the world.
What do you think should be done?
Well, at the end of the day, there has to be a response to this group. But how that response takes shape, is not something that I can comment on at this stage.
Mazhar Khan speaking with us from Edinburgh. He's with the Muslim Council of Scotland. Thank you very much, Mr. Khan. Appreciate it.
Thank you. You're welcome.
We've heard a lot recently about young people from different parts of the world heading to Syria to join the extremist cause there. Most of the cases involve men who are recruited as fighters. But as we've reported here on The World, there are some cases involving women, too. In Minnesota, the family of one young woman who disappeared recently believes she's in Syria now. Her relatives are being called to testify before a federal grand jury looking into a possible terrorist recruitment pipeline. Laura Yuen of Minnesota Public Radio talked to the young woman's sister and has our story.
The week she disappeared, the biggest worry on the young woman's mind seemed to be what to wear to a friend's bridal shower. A conservative Muslim, she was excited when she finally put on one of her sister's long dresses and a snug orange headscarf and liked how she looked. The woman's sister remembers her being upbeat. There was no hint about what would happen next.
She seems very excited to meet her friends. That's how she looked like to us. That's why we did not become any suspicious from her. We didn't ask any questions. We were just happy for her to go to the bridal shower and meet her friends.
I met the woman's sister at a coffee shop. She requested anonymity because of her sister's situation. Her sister's only 19 and from a large family of ethnic Somalis. They moved to St. Paul 5 years ago. On the night of the bridal shower, the woman left the house, but it's unclear whether she ever went to the gathering. She never came back. 2 days later, her mom's phone rang. She put her daughter on speakerphone so the rest of the family could hear.
She did say, "I'm sorry." She kept repeating, "I'm sorry, I left mom. I'm not in the city anymore, but I promised I will come back."
The young woman said she was in Syria, a place she'd never mentioned before. She told her mom not to worry and that she was there to finish memorizing the Quran. She'd been trying to do that in the States over the past few months, and her family worried that the already shy teenager was withdrawing even more. Then she called again and said she was enjoying the warm air in Syria and was living in a house with other young women. After the initial calls, the sister says family members alerted the FBI, asking to help them bring the woman home. They're panicked.
A lot of people are not doing good. My uncle, my mom, and us. She called 3 times. Still, it's not enough. Still waiting to hear more from her, especially her saying coming back. We want her to come back, like, as soon as possible.
The FBI declined to comment on this case, but the missing woman's sister says the FBI told her that 2 other women from Minnesota have also gone to Syria, where radical groups like ISIS or the Islamic State are recruiting foreigners to their ranks. At least 1 man with Minnesota ties has died fighting. And while some women are drawn to the militants in Syria, academics say the propaganda used to hook them can be different than the videos of beheadings aimed at men. Mia Bloom is a professor of security studies at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. She says on social media, the women recruiters of ISIS entice other women by promising a romantic notion of how their lives will change.
The kind of messages that come out from the women are one of sisterhood, one of great comfort, where the women are sitting around and they're baking cookies, or they're having these little parties where they're cooking and they're tweeting the pictures or they're posting it to Tumblr to show how wonderful their life is.
In truth, she says, ISIS sexually exploits its women, who are expected to help populate the Islamic State.
It's almost like a Margaret Atwood nightmare that, you know, this is what the women are good for. They use them only for rewarding the fighters and having babies.
Still, the family of the missing woman in St. Paul can't imagine her associating with terror groups. Again, here's her sister.
I don't see her with those people. And every time we see the news and all those terrified things going on, it makes us worry too much.
She says what the militants are doing is wrong, and she hopes the little sister she knows and loves would agree. For The World, I'm Laura Yuen, St. Paul.
6 years of hard labor in North Korea. That's what Matthew Todd Miller has in his immediate future. The 20-something U.S. citizen has been charged with, quote, hostile acts against the North Korean state. But there's a lot we don't know about Miller's case. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the story, and he's here in the studio with me now. What do we know about Matthew Todd Miller?
We know that he went to North Korea in April of this year with an official tour. He apparently, according to the North Korean state news agency, ripped up his visa when he got there, said that he wanted asylum. He was immediately detained. There's been a statement from the tour group saying this is unfortunate. We had no idea that this was going to happen with this particular customer of ours, but not many details there. Also, it's interesting, Marco, that this guy's family isn't saying much publicly either. So we just don't know a lot of details other than what's come out from North Korean reporting.
Was he arrested pretty much immediately after landing in North Korea back in April?
He was, and we didn't know what he would be charged with. There are two other Americans in custody in North Korea. One of them, Kenneth Bae, was charged in late 2012. He was a missionary, and apparently he was suspected of Christian missionary activity, which the North Korean government considers to be hostile to the regime there. There's another American who reportedly left a Bible behind when he was on an official tour. He hasn't been put on trial yet. Matthew Todd Miller, we haven't heard any details like this. This quote-unquote hostile acts charge is very vague. You would think that if the North Korean government thought that he was indeed an American spy, that he would have gotten a longer sentence. So again, there's a lot that's just not clear here.
Matthew Todd Miller has seemingly made a few statements, but one is a written confession, and for the most part, he hasn't really spoken freely on his own, has he? It's always been with North Korean officials in the background. This written confession, it was posted on Twitter, written all in caps, kind of said, "I want the Americans to leave the Korean Peninsula." Kind of weird. Do you believe this confession?
Right. That's a great question. And I don't really. I mean, it did show up. It was presented again today in this video that showed up. The Associated Press also has a bureau there in North Korea, and they presented things that Matthew Miller owned, like his iPad, his iPhone, his passport, and then this notebook, supposedly, that was his, and this confession that said in it that he wanted to rid South Korea of American military presence. Again, he's in North Korean detention, so I think we just have to assume that any statement he made, if indeed he did make that statement, was done under duress, and we have to look at it with a healthy bit of skepticism.
You know this well, that the thing with North Korea is we obviously don't ever have much to go on because the information is so scarce. So we tend to look at kind of circumstantial evidence. So is there something going on, or something in the background that North Korea watchers have been anticipating that this sentence of Matthew Todd Miller might be linked to?
Right. I think, you know, one thing that's always going on, and this has been going on for decades, is that North Korea is looking for international legitimacy, especially from the United States. North Korea is really not resolved the Korean War with South Korea. It's trying to gain legitimacy in the international community as a legitimate government and sort of the true representative of the Korean people, including ultimately the whole Korean Peninsula. Well, the Obama administration seems quite reluctant to sort of be seen as giving that legitimacy to North Korea. The administration has offered to send their special envoy for human rights to North Korea a couple of times, and the North Koreans have refused. That's sort of unsurprising because they don't want to talk about their own human rights record. They want to talk about larger things, and they want to show that they have some sort of bilateral relationship with the only superpower in the world.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
I want to give you guys a heads up on something. Tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to participate in a Reddit AMA. That's right. We're pulling back the curtains here at The World so you can AMA. Ask me anything. And apparently, I'm going to answer. Got a burning question for me on how we do things here in our Boston newsroom? It's all on the table. Should be fun. Again, that's tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern at reddit.com. It's The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from Lookout, using big data and predictive analytics to protect people and enterprises from mobile threats worldwide. More information at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. Mo Asumang is a German TV presenter and documentary maker. She is also a mixed-race German, the daughter of a Ghanaian father and a German mother. And she's no stranger to racist comments and neo-Nazi threats. She says one group that calls itself the White Aryan Rebels even threatened to kill her. Her response? She decided to explore the concept of Aryan-ness and the right-wing groups who identify with it, both in Germany and here in the U.S. She made a documentary about the experience called The Aryans. Today, I asked Mo what she was hoping to learn with this project.
I just wanted to find out what are Aryans, because nobody ever questions this. And then I found out that Aryans are not tall, blonde and blue-eyed, and they're not white. So that was very, very important to me, because it's like the counterpart. I'm like the dark German and they are the others. But I think we are all together. We are just one. We're Germans.
Yeah, so an Aryan, by definition, is somebody from Germany? Is that the definition?
No, exactly. It's not. You know, the word Iran means land of the Aryans. So I was researching, where does this come from, Aryan? And it actually comes from Iran, from old Persia, from parts of India. That's where the Aryans have been living. And the Germans are no Aryans. You know, in the Nazi time, they just took this word because they needed something against the Jews.
So tell us what happened when you came here to the U.S. You spoke with the Ku Klux Klan. How'd they react to you as an African German?
Well, I was a little bit shocked, because at the back seat there were two machine guns, and the guy who was sitting at the steering wheel, is that how you say?
Mm-hmm.
He had his hood on in the car, and then, well, they came out of the car and we were talking about cross burnings and stuff like that.
So how does this discussion with the Klan in the American South then kind of unfold? I mean, what are you talking about in terms of Aryan-ness?
You know, I wanted to know everything. Why do they hate black people? I mean, what's the thing between Ku Klux Klan and black people? So I asked all the questions. For instance, why do you do this cross-burning? And they say, well, we do this cross-burning because it's for Jesus, because Jesus goes from darkness to light. And then I answer, but Jesus loves black people.
And how did they respond?
Silence.
Oh, right.
Yeah, well, the hood was moving to the right, to the left, to the front. It looked a little bit funny, but they didn't know what to say. I don't know why people don't ask these things. I mean, all the hundreds of years, Ku Klux Klan is burning crosses. Nobody's asking this. I mean, Jesus loves black people. So how could you burn a cross for Jesus? And because it's also for his meanings and for his beliefs. So I think it's totally nuts to do things like that.
There's actually one sequence in your film where you show a young racist a photo of your white grandmother, who was a member of the SS. And this is kind of a oddly poignant scene. Can you just explain it and what you were feeling when this was happening?
Yes, at the end of the film, I meet a neo-Nazi that wanted to go out of the scene. And I showed him the picture of my grandmother, who raised me and who was in the SS, but I only knew just some, maybe 6 months before the film shooting, that my grandmother was in the SS. And actually, I think this picture, the neo-Nazi together with me, and then you have this picture of the SS grandmother, it just shows we can come together. It's possible. Even the SS grandmother raised a black child. Can you imagine? And it's possible. We only have to give it a try.
Mo Asumong, touring the U.S., attending screenings of her documentary, The Aryans, later this month. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If life is challenging for Mo in Germany, imagine what it's like for the tens of thousands of African immigrants who don't have a solid job when they go to Europe. In other words, the vast majority of migrants. In the past week, not one, but two tragic stories of rickety boats making the risky journey from North Africa across the Mediterranean to Europe. One last week, if the details that are now emerging are accurate, will be the worst such shipwreck in decades. It involves human traffickers ramming a boat filled with migrants. As many as 500 of them have died. Another one this weekend, 250 dead, as their boat sunk off the coast of Libya. Activists are saying the problem is out of control and that few governments are taking the problem seriously enough. A fresh voice in that activism is actually not a young man. Tony Allen is 74, now living in Paris. He's a Nigerian musician, the former drummer for the late band leader Fela Kuti, and his new recording, Film of Life, has several songs that deal with these frequent migration tragedies.
Don't tell the boat journey, my brothers. Don't tell the boat journey, my sisters.
Running away from misery. Running away from misery. Running away from misery. And you can find yourself in a double misery.
Tony Allen has been touring the U.S. with the ensemble The Chicago Afrobeat Project. This past weekend, I caught up with him to talk about the risks of leaving Africa on these small boats for an elusive, brighter future, as that song makes reference to. I wanted Tony Allen to see a photograph that has deeply affected me. It's of a small boat groaning under the weight of a couple hundred migrants, taken from above. It's a shocking picture. Allen shakes his head and reflects on how life is so horrible for these people back home that they're willing to risk it all. For them, he says, it's like playing the lottery. I ask him, what do you do? How do you fix this?
I don't have no solution. My own solution is that if they can stay back home and then ask for aid, get the aid and make use of it back home there, it will be better.
I think if you were to ask kind of smart people in Nigeria what to do, they would say, well, the government should stop being so corrupt and then there would be more money to invest in people back home and then these people wouldn't have to leave.
The government of their place? The government of their place, I mean, you know, every African government, they just think about themselves. There's no any social assistance or anything in the country. Making the people make their move. I made my move because my country is just becoming crazy and I'm a musician and I need to operate. It's the nightlife died, you know, and I work in the night. And I'm not going to do any other job because I was doing other jobs before. I decided to be strictly a musician and professional. And then I'm not going back to that. So I need to pursue what I had in my hand.
What Tony Allen has in his hands is a pair of drumsticks. For an instrumentalist, his minor key single, Go Back, is a plea for greater attention to the problem. It helps that he's got Britpop singer Damon Albarn from Blur laying out the lyrics.
Does anyone, what am I gonna do with you if you go? Does anyone, what am I gonna do with you if you go back? Does anyone see you left out all the wrongs?
Damon Albarn there with Nigerian drummer Tony Allen. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on the world, the Grimm's fairy tales have been retranslated so many times, they've lost their punch. One author went to the originals, restored missing details, and read them to school kids.
And I think it did a pretty decent job, because when I looked up, every child had the same look on his face. Every kid looked traumatized. I think traumatized is the word.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Want to get an idea of how serious the Ebola crisis is in West Africa? The U.S. today called for a special meeting of the United Nations Security Council this week to discuss how to contain the Ebola outbreak. More than 2,400 people have died from the disease so far. The hardest hit country in West Africa is Liberia. Last week on The World, we heard how patients there are being turned away by overwhelmed doctors and hospitals and clinics. Today, I spoke with Dr. Joya Mukherjee with the group Partners in Health. They're based here in Boston, and they've just announced an ambitious multi-year project to combat the Ebola outbreak. In fact, I spoke with Mukherjee just hours before she and her team board a plane bound for West Africa.
We are heading to Liberia with our friends from Last Mile Health, which is a grassroots organization that we helped to found and start. It's an organization we believe in. They do grassroots work, paying frontline health workers to be in villages, to connect people to health care at the primary health care level. And so when our friends in Last Mile started to see cases and suspect cases of Ebola, they asked for our help because they are a small organization and younger than Partners in Health and needed our support. And, you know, of course, we feel compelled to enter into this international crisis of the Ebola outbreak. And so we will be going on this delegation, first and foremost, to support the people of Liberia morally and say, you know, we're here, we're willing to help, and to see together with our friends from Last Mile Health how Partners in Health can help to strengthen the work on the ground of Last Mile in terms of increasing the footprint of these community health workers, increasing the skill set and the knowledge at the primary healthcare level, and then to decentralize treatment for Ebola once those cases are identified to the rural districts where Last Mile Health is working.
It sounds like a clear point-by-point strategy, but, you know, we're hearing that the health infrastructure in Liberia is so overwhelmed that people who are presenting initial signs of Ebola, you know, like vomiting and serious fatigue, are being turned away from clinics because the clinics are so full and essentially told, come back when you're really sick. Are you worried that any strategy you have in place may just have to be put on pause because the need is so big for just smart medical hands on deck like yourselves?
No. I'm not worried that any strategy would have to be put on hold. I think we're fortunate, again, that we're working with an organization that's already there. They're already providing care. They're providing ongoing primary health care to a population that is largely rural and fortunately does not yet have the major burden of disease, though there have been cases confirmed and suspected in those regions, those more rural regions. So our hope is that we can, by joining forces, provide Ebola case finding, contact tracing, prevention at the community level in conjunction with treatment in a decentralized way that can maybe help to get ahead a little bit in the rural areas that are not yet overwhelmed with this disease. So I'm not worried that the strategy will be put on pause. I'm more worried that the international community will do too little to respond. We need much more money for this. This is an international crisis. If we think about how much money was allocated to control the spread of SARS, which at the height of SARS, I believe only 600 people died, which is very terrible. But here we're already in the thousands.
Right, more than 1,200 dead from the disease in Liberia alone. And that's
in Liberia alone, right. So whatever long-term strategy we employ, we have to rebuild and build. Sometimes it's not a question of rebuild. Build health infrastructure that can really deal with this.
This crisis has been roiling since March. Why do you think the response has been so slow?
Unfortunately, Marco, I think it's racism. I think it's racism. And
Lay you know, that out for us. What's
your
argument?
Well, I think it's easy for the world, the powerful of the world, who are largely non-African, non-people of color, to ignore the suffering of poor black people. And, you know, and I think also classism. These are not countries that contribute massively to the global economy. And so it's easy to just sort of otherize this problem. It's not going to impact us. And I think, first of all, it may very well impact us if we don't get it under control. But perhaps more importantly, from a humanity perspective, not humanitarian, but humanity perspective, is we're one humanity. And the suffering of people in Liberia or Sierra Leone is no different than suffering where I live in Brookline in terms of the impact on a mother, on a father, you know, on brothers and sisters. And so we really feel that the notion of solidarity here is so critical, that people feel that this is truly painful to others and really try to assume some of that responsibility.
Dr. Joya Mukherjee, Chief Medical Officer at Partners in Health here in Boston and a professor at Harvard Medical School. She'll be taking off for Liberia tonight with a team of doctors and other health professionals. Thanks very much. Stay safe.
Thank you, Marco.
Michael Jang has had a successful career as a commercial photographer. Over the years, he's shot portraits of figures as diverse as Jimi Hendrix, Robin Williams, and Ronald Reagan. But recently, the San Francisco-based photographer stepped forward with an archive of private photos he took during the 70s when he was a student. These are family photos, and they document Chinese-American life from the inside. Here's Alina Simone with the story.
When I asked Michael Jang, who's jokingly called himself the Rip Van Winkle of photography, why he waited more than 30 years to reveal these photos of his family, he gave a couple of different answers. This:
I just did it for fun, and it was homework, and I didn't get that much positive feedback at the time from my teachers, and I just didn't think it was any big deal.
And this:
In the 50s and 60s, being Chinese was a lot different than being Asian in the new millennium. I didn't feel doors were that open, so I kind of didn't have aspirations to being well-known as a photographer or an artist.
The reason for keeping them private was probably a mix of both. But in the same way the contents of a time capsule gain significance just by being temporarily forgotten, Michael Jang's unappreciated homework feels like a revelation today. The Jangs is a story of American assimilation, but it's not the story you're used to hearing about Chinese Americans. Because Michael Jang's cousins aren't playing the math nerd in an after-school special. They're reading Mad Magazine, going record shopping, walking on stilts in their underwear. Their bedrooms are covered in football posters. Their dad is asleep on the shag carpet.
In retrospect, I'm pretty sure there isn't anything, a document like this, of Chinese in America in the 70s.
The series came about almost by accident in 1973 when Michael was in college and signed up for a photography workshop with the legendary Lisette Modell in San Francisco.
I stayed with my cousins close by. They let me stay there this summer and I realized what a gold mine they were. So I just started photographing them and bringing that work into class. They just had a crazy lifestyle.
A lot of us have families with a crazy lifestyle, but our photos still suck. Because it's not just about knowing your f-stops or having the right lens. If you want a family photo album like the Jangs, you have to be tenacious and fearless.
When you kind of photograph your own family, it's very hard. You'll get the hand in the face, you know, just don't do this. And it just makes you want to quit. But I was persistent, and I think I just basically broke them down. Luckily, they were good sports.
Luckily because?
They certainly weren't crazy about the photographs either. They weren't necessarily flattering. I tend to go for the jugular when humor is involved.
Humor is definitely involved. Take, for example,
this photograph of my aunts and uncles dancing and wearing hipster dark glasses in the 70s. I had this basket full of sunglasses that were just a collection of fun stuff because I used to do rock and roll and everything. Everyone chose them and put them on, and it just ended up being the last shot of the whole series. In fact, you can look at it. I wasn't even framed. I actually missed it. People are kind of off center and they're looking away, and the whole group is kind of breaking up. And who would have thunk it, right, that this is going to be in the Museum of Modern Art someday?
Who would have thunk it, in part because, let's face it, the words funny and fine art don't often go together.
I recall experiences of going to museums and it almost feeling like walking through a mausoleum. You're not going to hear anyone laughing in there. The humor wasn't intentional, it just is, and I think that's what may set it apart from a lot of work.
And back when Michael began shooting the Jangs, the words Chinese and photographer didn't often go together either.
On the fame level of, say, Adams as in Ansel, or Avedon as in Richard, or even Arbus as in Deanne, and I'm just in the A's here, what Chinese photographer comes to mind at that level? And most people draw blank.
The humor of these photographs, together with the polyester pantsuits and carpeted bathrooms, has a lot of critics calling the Jangs the Asian American Brady Bunch. Look closely and you'll notice the rice cooker on the counter, the kung fu movie playing on the TV, a wall calendar from Chong Imports. But mostly you'll just find yourself thinking, the Jangs are more American than you, and they probably had more fun. For the World, this is Alina Simone.
I don't know. I had a lot of fun as a kid, but Michael Jang's family really looked like, along with the bell-bottoms and shag carpets, they had a laugh or three. Lots of goofing off. You can see that, too, at PRI.org. If you think parallel parking is hard, then you'll be blown away by what the European Space Agency is getting ready to do. They're hoping to land a small robot on a moving comet. Comet 67P is barreling through space at more than 34,000 miles an hour. The Rosetta mission to the comet will investigate the comet for clues about the origins of the universe. Our friend Kelly Beatty is at Sky and Telescope. I mean, forget the parallel parking metaphors. This has got to be harder than landing a jet on an aircraft carrier.
Oh, very much so, Marco. I mean, what they're going to do on November 11th is release this lander, which is about the size and weight of a washing machine, and it's going to dead stick. It's literally going to drop onto the comet's surface at maybe 2 miles an hour when it lands. Now, that doesn't sound like much. The problem is not that it will crash, but that it might bounce off. So as soon as it touches down, It's got three legs, and there are screws in the bottoms of its feet to auger itself in, and there's a harpoon that's going to anchor it to this comet so that it won't bounce away when they do the drilling and other things that it's going to be doing in the months afterward.
How big is this comet?
The comet itself is about 2.5 miles long, 4 kilometers long, but that's not giving it a good sense because it's really two giant segments sort of cemented together at a waist. Was it two objects that sort of cemented themselves together? Or is it one object that's been eroding away around its midsection and is about to fly apart? That is one of the things that Rosetta and Philae, the lander, hope to answer. Now, you called it 67P. The P means that it's periodic. It goes around the sun every 6.5 years, and it's on its way in. It will warm up by the sun's rays as it gets closer to the sun, and it passes its closest point next August. So the point of this whole mission is to catch up with the comet, which they've done, and to kind of fly in formation with it to watch all the things that happen, all the seething and sputtering and spitting that take place as those primordial gases and ices heat up and fly away.
So what are we actually, we Homo sapiens down here on Earth, what are we going to learn from this? Why does this need doing?
It's called Rosetta for a reason. Comets are sort of leftovers from the formation of our solar system. So literally, this object is 4.5 billion years old and is largely untouched since that time. So by understanding what this comet is made of, and not just in terms of like, is it rocky, is it icy, but right down to the isotopic level, we can have a window on the processes that were going on when the sun and planets came together. That's really important. We've gone to asteroids before. We've landed on asteroids before. This is a first for a comet. And with Philae, that lander, in place on the surface, we'll be able to watch the comet wake up as it nears the sun, get a sense of, like, what are the chunks flying off of it? Are they boulder size, or are they particles or smoke? What is it? This will all give us insight into the origin of comets, and from there, the origin of our solar system.
What do you think the odds are that they will actually be able to stick this robot on this comet moving at 34,000 miles an hour?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There was a press briefing this morning by the European Space Agency, and they estimated that when they designed the mission, they figured it was a success rate of maybe 70 to 75%. Those were the odds of success. That didn't factor in the fact that they've got a comet, which is this craggy, irregular. And besides that, even though it's still roughly 300 million miles from the sun, it's already active. All of these things are making the landing much more challenging. And pointedly, the scientists involved did not offer revised odds of success. So I think they have their work cut out for them.
The robot that will be on the comet, it's not like it's just sitting there. They also have to kind of like stick it and literally screw it into the comet's surface.
That's right. It has to anchor it down. It's got a drill on it that will go in about 9 inches to try to tap into some of the material deeper down that's been unprocessed, never warmed by the sun and so forth. That's the really pristine material that they're after. But just that process of drilling would be enough to cause the comet to shake and shimmy and maybe, you know, break away.
So 13 months, it'll be on this comet, and then the mission is over?
Yeah, the Rosetta orbiter will be accompanying the comet for at least 13 months. The odds are pretty good. They're hoping to get 4 or 5 months out of the lander. It's running on a combination of batteries and solar cells. But if it doesn't get enough sunlight, you know, it's a pretty ambitious lander, and they're hoping for 4 or 5 months. If it lasts longer, they'll count that as gravy.
The other thing that I want to ask you about is the name of this comet, because 67P is an abbreviation. What is its full name? It's got Russian in there.
It's named after two Russians who discovered it. It's Churyumov Gerasimenko, and those are the two astronomers who discovered it. So if you really want to become famous in astronomy, Marco, discover a comet, and it'll be named after you.
I kind of like 67P personally. Senior editor Kelly Beatty at Sky and Telescope telling us about the Rosetta mission to Comet 67P. Great to see you again, Kelly.
As always, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Books change when they're translated from one language to another. Sometimes it's the inevitable side effect of finding the right words in another language. But for some, a translation is actually an opportunity to deliberately change the original material. That's what we want to explore today as part of our series on translation, in other words. And we're focusing now on some stories that have changed the most in translation, the fairy tales collected by the Brothers Grimm and published in the early 19th century, stories like Cinderella and Snow White. Adam Gidwitz has retold many of the best-known Grimm stories in books like A Tale Dark and Grim. Gidwitz says it was only a few years after the stories were first published in German that deliberate mistranslations began to appear.
In 1823, Edgar Taylor published an English edition, and it was scholarly. If you read his introduction to the volume, he sees himself as a scholar sharing the scholarly work of the Brothers Grimm with the English scholarly public. He does, though, acknowledge that children might be attracted to these stories, and for that reason, he has amended them to some degree. So, for example, in the 1812 edition of Snow White that the Brothers Grimm published, when Snow White's stepmother, or mother in some versions, sends the huntsman out to the forest with Snow White, in the Grimm version, she says, "Take little Snow White out into the forest, and I want you to kill her. And I want you to cut out her lungs and her liver and bring them back to me so that I may boil them in salt and eat them."
Du sollst es töten und mir Lunge und Leber zum Wahrzeichen mitbringen.
Yeah, that part didn't get into the Disney version.
It certainly didn't, and it also didn't get into the English version. So in the English version, he says, "Take little Snow White out into the forest and lose her."
Adam, you take it a step further, as you've done in A Tale Dark and Grim and the follow-ups. How do you go about that, though? I mean, when you retell the Grimm brothers, what's your starting point, the English translation, or do you dig further back and kind of focus group with kids today on what will work and how much detail do you want to keep in that is kind of embedded in grotesqueness?
I start with my favorite translation of the Grimm's fairy tales, which is Ralph Mannheim's translation. He keeps the lyric quality as well as all the blood and the gore. And then I tell them to children. So the first time I ever told these stories to children, I was supposed to be a substitute librarian for a day. And I was thinking of that time when I first heard the real Grimm's fairy tales. And I took the book off the shelf and I opened it up to a story called Faithful Johannes. And in this story, children get their heads cut off by their parents. And I read that and I thought, huh, that's interesting. Can I read this to second graders? And then I thought, let's find out. So I brought the book in and I started reading it to the kids. And very quickly I started to notice that they were getting nervous, a little uncomfortable. So I would make jokes to calm them down, or I would warn them when something really terrible was about to happen. And I think I did a pretty decent job, because when I looked up, every child had the same look on his face. Every kid looked traumatized. I think traumatized is the word. So I dismissed the children. Some of them were crying. I think one little boy peed his pants. But a few of them came up to me afterwards, and they were shaking. But one of them pointed her finger in my face, and she said, "That was good." And I said, "What?" She said, "You should make that into a book."
Wow.
And I thought, huh, maybe I should. So I read the stories, and then always I tell them to children. I add in jokes. I highlight the scary parts, or I downplay the parts that I don't think they're enjoying. And then I retell them in my books.
A Tale Dark and Grim, which is your book which kind of started this whole trilogy, they've been translated now themselves into German. So any reaction from the German-speaking world about these tales that have gone through so many mutations and now your interpretation has been translated back into German?
I think the Germans are very attached to the Grimm's fairy tales, and I was therefore very pleased that I get a lot of positive feedback from the Germans. I think they like it when Grimm's tales get recognized. I had one amusing experience with a translation. I got an email from a young girl from Thailand. She said, "In my culture, you can't say that a brother is just a brother or a sister is just a sister. It's always an older brother or a younger brother, an older sister or a younger sister. So who's older, Hansel or Gretel?" And now in my version of the story, they're twins, even if in the original they're not. And so I said, "Well, they're twins. They're the same age." And she said, "No, that's not possible. In my culture, it's always older brother, younger brother."
Somebody still has to come out first.
Exactly. So I said, "I don't know. Who do you think it is?" And she says, "Well, on this..." She's writing me emails every time, every interaction.
Wow.
She says, "Well, on this page, Gretel seems older. But on this page, Hansel seems older. So which is it?" And I say, "Kid, I don't know." And she writes back and says, "The reason I'm so curious is I am the Thai translator of your book, and it's important for me to know." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, had you just told me that in the first place, I would have arbitrarily chosen Gretel." So Gretel
meet
is
your
older
translator.
And Thai. Yes.
Adam Gidwitz, author of A Tale Dark and Grim, In a Glass Grimly, and The Grim Conclusion. Great to meet you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for talking.
And you can hear Adam Gidwitz telling his version of Snow White in our latest World in Words podcast. Here's a little snippet of that.
One day, when Snow White was maybe 7 years old, her mother looked in the mirror and she said, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest of them all?" And the mirror looked back and said, "You, queen, are the fairest here, but little Snow White is fairer than you by far." And her mother said, "What? I'm going to kill that little punk." Or something like that. It's translated, so that's approximate.
A little parenting assistance is in order there, perhaps. To hear the rest, just go to pri.org/language. Now, something else that gets translated and changed a lot is the music inspired by fairy tales. That's Tchaikovsky from his ballet, The Sleeping Beauty, based on the Charles Perrault version of The Sleeping Beauty story, a famous piece of music made even more famous by this.
I know.
Yep, Disney, the 1959 animated classic Sleeping Beauty. That's Anne-Marie Costa singing. The film was based loosely on the Perrault and Grimm versions of the story. It sounds almost jolly.
It's true that visions are seldom all they see.
But this piece of music, like a Grimm story, continues to undergo radical change. This year, Disney unveiled a much darker version to go with a much darker take on the Sleeping Beauty tale. The singer there is Lana Del Rey. That's from the movie Maleficent.
I know you, that look in your eyes is so familiar, ugly, and I know it's true that visions are seldom all they see.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow, happily ever after.
You'll love me at once, the way you did once, upon a dream.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today, annenbergfoundation.org, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.